Our connection this hour was made in a courtroom in Ireland, where a mother was weeping. Her 2-month-old son had died suddenly, and she blamed herself. Jolene Hanlon was devastated about the loss of a baby boy. Jolene explained that her son had seemed chilly in his blanket, so she brought him into bed to sleep with her. She wanted what was best for him, but overnight, Jolene rolled onto him, and he was not able to breathe. The boy passed away before the morning hours. In court, Jolene said she wanted to tell her story so other parents would hear it. She broke down in tears, screaming that she blamed herself, at which point the coroner interjected. He called her brave and a loving mother who should be commended for raising awareness about co-sleeping. This hour, we are not here to judge parents. We know parents already feel so much judgment across society. There's hardly anything more stressful than the first few months of a child's life. But the medical community has strong views on the practice known as co-sleeping. We're discussing it today because you might have seen a headline in the New York Post that went viral last week. That headline read, quote, "American parents, calm the F down. Co-sleeping isn't always dangerous," end quote. The author of the piece writes that the fears about co-sleeping are overblown or examples of misunderstanding. Doctors, generally speaking, could hardly believe what they were reading, and we're giving them the chance to discuss it with us this hour. In studio, we welcome Dr. Elizabeth Murray, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
On the line with us is Dr. Stephen Schultz, who's Medical Director and a pediatrician at Rochester Regional Health's Finger Lakes Medical Associates in Geneva and Medical Director for Rochester Regional Health's Monroe County Pediatric Medical Practices. Dr. Schultz, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
Good. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Murray, I'm going to start with you because I'd like you, if you could, to summarize the reaction that you experienced when that New York Post headline, not just the headline, let me just read a little bit here. And I want to be careful because I know this upset a lot of people in the medical community, but I'll read a little bit and then we'll get your response and what you were saying. The New York Post wrote, "Parents, relax. Your infant can sleep in your bed. Your toddler can share your dinner and your one-year-old can amuse herself just fine." Goes on to say, "You can let your baby sleep in their bed. Most American babies sleep in their own crib, away from mom and dad. The American Academy of Pediatrics even cautions against having babies sleep in the same bed as their parents, as it is the number one cause of sudden infant death syndrome. However, according to a study published in Current Pediatric Reviews in 2010, many of the countries with the lowest rates of SIDS are places where co-sleeping is the norm, such as Japan. Don't be so afraid," end quote. That's the New York Post. What did you think when you saw that headline and saw that piece?
Well, I first didn't know what was happening because I received an onslaught of texts and direct messages, and I didn't know what was going on. I thought something had happened to a family member because I got so many notifications, and it was about this article because as an emergency medicine doctor who worked overnights for almost 10 years, I cared for these families a lot because the majority of these deaths will come in the early morning hours because somebody wakes up and realizes the baby didn't wake for a feed. And I'm part of the Safe Sleep Coalition here, too. And it's just, again, I'm struck by we know that 100% of these deaths are preventable. Historically, these were bunched in with SIDS. And yes, the risk factors that can cause SIDS, and I'm sorry, the preventative measures to try to prevent SIDS overlap a great deal with the safe sleep stuff, but it's a separate entity. There is no mystery here as to why these children are dying. It is a suffocation death. And now that we are investigating these more, we have a better understanding of it. Now, having said that, I am a parent of 2 children. My oldest was premature. My second child was adopted and come to live with us until she was a couple weeks old. And so we had all sorts of different sleep struggles. And I get it. 100% being a parent is the hardest job we will take on. And we are sleep deprived for a huge percentage of it, especially at that front end. But I do know that there's things that we can do to increase our own muscle memory, if you will, to make sure that we're keeping our babies in a safe environment.
Give me one word to describe your thoughts on the New York Post headline, "American parents, calm the F down. Co-sleeping isn't always dangerous."
Dangerous is my word.
It's a dangerous headline.
It's a dangerous headline. Yeah. And it's, I think that people have questions about this topic. I think it's a very emotional topic for people, and I understand why it's an emotional topic. But if there's people out there that were looking for approval, this gave them that approval.
Dr. Schultz, what did you make of that story in the Post?
I agree with Dr. Murray. This is concerning. We have research, and we know that co-sleeping is not safe sleeping. you know, we certainly understand there's cultural differences, and I think the article was trying to draw on that, and that's a little bit of the art of medicine and shared decision-making. I see my job as a pediatrician to provide the most up-to-date evidence-based guidelines so that parents can make an informed decision, and this is an area where we have research that says we know co-sleeping is a danger for SIDS.
And Dr. Schultz, I'll ask you and then Dr. Murray to kind of elaborate a little bit on the importance of, I think, threading a challenging needle, which is saying to parents, you know, we empathize. We don't judge you per se. I mean, this is not about shaming parents, knowing that there are a lot of parents who co-sleep and defend it. And they often say, you know, my kids were fine. And I'll read some feedback in a moment here. At the same time saying, we know what the evidence says. How do you thread that needle, Dr. Schultz? What do you say to parents when they come in and they tell you, I'm exhausted, it's worked out well so far. What do you say?
Well, and a lot of this comes down to a lot of things in medicine is a risk-benefit analysis. And, you know, you're right, there are plenty of families that co-sleep and their kids do grow up and do just fine. But the question is, do you want to take that risk? Do you want to have that possibility of your child being the one who doesn't wake up? And, you know, these cases do happen. There's been 99 cases in Monroe County between 2007 and 2017, about 10 a year. 52% of those were co-sleeping. And we've actually had a couple of cases in Geneva this year as well. So it's hit home recently for us as well.
So I'm just trying to do a little math. I mean, roughly 5 children every year die in Monroe County alone from co-sleeping.
So we have roughly 10 unsafe sleep deaths. So co-sleeping and unsafe sleep go together, but some of those deaths are babies being put face down with blankets and pillows. So they might be in a crib, but it's a very unsafe sleep environment.
Okay. But at least 5, if not more, co-sleeping deaths every year in this county. And we're going to work through a number of things this hour. We're going to talk about legal liability. I mean, I know it sounds rough, but we'll talk about that. But let me also hit some of the feedback we've already had here. Millie writes to us and says, I co-slept with all 3 of mine, and I followed the recommendations of Dr. Sears for safely co-sleeping. My youngest is now 6. Dr. Murray, what would you say to Millie?
Dr. Sears right now, I believe, is on suspension from the California Board of Medicine because of some choices he's made with regards to his patients. So I don't really consider him a great source
of advice.
A reputable
source.
I think that the American Academy of Pediatrics really worked hard in their last statement to meet parents where they are, understanding that there are going to be times, well, parents are always exhausted, and there are going to be times where a parent is going to identify that, you know, I am so exhausted, but I am yet feeding this baby. I need to make sure that I'm doing the safest possible thing. So in the most recent guidelines, they did talk about making things as safe as possible if you are concerned that a co-sleeping situation is going to happen. But let's be clear, that was not saying this is a safe way to do it. This was mitigating your risks.
Okay, so this is maybe the most important part of this conversation we can have this hour, because what Dr. Murray is talking about is something that parents have already written into us about. Maybe I'm interpreting and I'm trying to learn here, maybe confusing a little bit of the idea of, if you're in a situation where you're worried that you could zonk out, keep this in mind versus this might be a safe way to co-sleep. So, and again, I say this when I read every one of these messages, we're not shaming or, you know, trying to make parents feel bad. There's no question. Parents love their kids and want what's best for their kids. Exhaustion's rough. Chris writes and says, I followed these guidelines. I've co-slept and bed shared with both of my children. And she's referring to the AAP. She says the AAP released guidelines to bed share more safely. So that's accurate as far as it goes, Dr. Murray. But again, let's make sure that you're underscoring the point here.
Right, exactly. It's to do it more safely, not this is a safe way to do it. And it sounds like it's splitting hairs, but basically what they're saying is, you know, if you're in a situation where your baby is breastfeeding, maybe they're doing cluster feeds, so it seems like every 30 minutes you're feeding your baby and understandably exhausted, if you were to the mom and the baby to be in a large bed with no blankets, with no sheets, only one adult in the middle of the bed, that is going to be a safer situation than, again, two parents, regular bedding, pillows, and baby in bed for that feeding experience, or moving to a comfy armchair or a couch. Those other situations are all very, very dangerous, even though you might not think about it intuitively. What the data tells us is that unsafe sleep deaths happen in armchairs and couches a great deal.
Dr. Schultz, what would you tell parents who kind of come in and say, yeah, I read those guidelines, and they're telling us how to do it more safely?
I would say that the point is really that there's always a risk. And again, how much risk are you willing to take? And we know that the most risk-free way to have baby and sharing a bedroom with parents and through at least the first 6 months, if not a year, just not the same bed, ideally.
Kat writes to say, I gave in and I slept with and next to my baby in a way that I felt was safe for both of us, and I wish I had done it sooner than 5 months old. The intense sleep deprivation was much more dangerous, in my opinion. Dr. Murray, what would you say?
Sleep deprivation is really dangerous. I think that babies can actually do pretty well if they're in a bassinet right next to a parent and very close by. I don't think they have to be far away to be in their own safe sleep space. But again, we just want to make sure people are entering into their decisions, understanding all of the risks. Everyday people are going to need to make decisions that works best for them. But I would say when it comes to safe sleep, make sure you're making that decision for you in that moment today versus a universal. Meaning, if you make the decision to do this all of the time, that's going to dramatically increase your risk because your exposure is going up. Versus right now, we're in a bad night or we're a bad couple of nights, and we're going to change our routine a little bit here right now. Again, a blanket, if you take a blanket statement of this is how we're going to do it forever, that's just going to increase your risk. And I think that I'm very glad that those people have had great outcomes. I am thinking about the literally dozens and dozens of families that I've talked to that did not have that good outcome.
You've been in those situations?
Yes, repeatedly.
And over and over again. I'm sure it is shocking every single time for the family, isn't it?
100%. Nobody comes in saying, well, we were expecting this to happen. No, this shouldn't have happened. We love our child. We were doing what we thought was best. I'm breastfeeding. We wanted the baby nearby. There's a variety of different things. No one would ever enter into something trying to hurt their child. I firmly believe that. No, everyone is doing the very best that they can. It's just, we got to make sure we understand the risks.
Dr. Schultz, what would you say to Kat's contention that there can be times where sleep deprivation is even more dangerous than a risk of a co-sleeping death?
Sleep deprivation does have concerns, mental health and driving accidents and things like that. So, again, it's always weighing risks and benefits of things. You know, I think there are other ways that can be helpful for babies to have healthy sleep. I mean, we know that they're going to wake and feed more often in the early months, but there's certain routines and patterns that can be put in place, being in a consistent location, a consistent bed, having the baby fall asleep in the crib or bassinet as opposed to in your arms. Those sorts of things can help try to mitigate some of that sleep deprivation, but again, the safest sleep is in the separate crib or bassinet.
Dr. Schultz, I know it's a tight calendar. Thanks for making the time for the program today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let me continue with some of the feedback. Kat goes on to say, Dr. Murray, that she believes that, you know, some people just sleep differently. And she says there's no one-size-fits-all when it comes to sleep. I felt it was fine to sleep next to my baby without a pillow because I was not a deep sleeper. I didn't move much, and I was nursing practically every hour. Not the case with everyone, but we were safe. Is that a fair assessment, you think?
You know, I think that there's a lot of myths that when these co-sleeping deaths occur, that the parents must be obese or, you know, using some substances or something else along that. Deep sleepers, snorers, whatever the case may be. I mean, I encourage people to go to the Baby Safe Sleep Coalition website and watch the video that they have there, because they talk to two different parents. The one is of a father who is, I've met him in real life. He's maybe 5 feet tall. He's not a huge hulk of a person, but he talks about this very thing, and how he never in a million years would have thought he wouldn't have been able to feel his child struggle against him. And just when you think, I mean, what we know is you put a sheet over a newborn baby's face and that's enough to suffocate them. They don't have the ability to clear things in front of their face.
Christy Rice says, I co-slept, same bed, super safely, all three of my kids. There is just no universe where I'm going to give birth to them in my bed and then kick them out 12 hours later.
I don't think anybody's asking people to put their babies away elsewhere and not be involved or attached to them. Again, I think that you can have a baby close by you and still have them be safe. I mean, we had a bassinet attached right next to the bed. And so I literally could have my arm right on my baby at all times if I needed to.
So this is a case where Christy is concerned about the feeling of kicking her baby out, which, by the way, Christy, I mean, like, I understand. I mean, like, you want to be close to your baby. You
sure.
don't want...
And you still are. I think, you know, teaching our kids how to develop and grow and do the things they need to do in life is really an important part of parenting, right? And so once, you know, the first few months, babies are not necessarily forming habits, but once they get to be about 6 months of age, you know, their awareness of the world becomes very great. And so they form routines and they form habits. And so if they are falling asleep in a certain way, that's their expectation. And that's truly, as parents, we are creating our child's reality. And so that is what they are going to expect forever. And so if this is happening for the first year of their life or longer, then all of a sudden you try to make that change, that's going to be much, much harder than when they're in this infancy and just trying to learn what the expectations of the world are.
And a child sleeping in a crib or a bassinet is not kicking them out necessarily.
No, they're right next to you. You can hear them.
But I also don't want to say that without empathy for someone like Christy, who feels like that's what it would emotionally feel like in that moment. You know, I mean, we've been
there.
Of course.
I mean, we have children because we love them and they're part of us and we want to get them close. And yeah, so I mean, that all makes perfect sense. But again, I think that I can counter every story with a horrible story. And so it's not necessarily worth going through all the anecdotes because lots of people have had good outcomes. Lots of people have not. And maybe today we'll hear from some of those people who experienced tragedies. Maybe we won't, because I could imagine, well, in the families that I've talked to who do participate with the Safe Sleep Coalition, you know, it's amazing their strength that they're able to talk about and how still one mom lost her child almost 17 years ago. And still, understandably, it feels like yesterday to her.
I want to ask a question that's not a leading question. It's just something that sort of comes to my mind as we think about research and evidence. Because even the conversations we've had about vaccines, I think should still center on the idea that parents who resist vaccination, I mean, they love their kids.
100%.
No
100%,
question.
No question.
No question.
Yep,
and I'm not, you know, I understand the emotion that can come in debates like that. But I think it's almost never a good idea to shame somebody, especially if they love their kid and they think they're doing what's best for their kid.
Agree, 100%. And I think that's how all pediatricians, I think all pediatricians that feel that way, because we're in this job because we want to help you love your kids and raise great kids. We want our own kids to be great and we love our own children. And so we want to make a healthy community, a healthy society. And we want to help you however you need help.
And the reason I bring up vaccines is we have a mountain of evidence and we have a society that is blessedly mostly free of some of the worst, most ravaging diseases. And it's probably easy to sort of lose sight of that because we haven't lived through some of the worst because of vaccines. And yet, you still have a vocal small minority of people who resist that. And again, I mean, I'm not questioning your motives if you're part of that population, but that is a resistance to the evidence. Is co-sleeping moving in a direction where we have enough evidence to say, we know you love your kids, but you are resisting the evidence now and it's our duty to say that?
I think so. And I think that the public perception of it is very limited just because these stories don't get covered by the news, because people are not, we don't have charges pressed. There's no law enforcement involved in this. You know, these are terrible, awful tragedies. But unless you look at the statistics over the year, and somebody happens to write a story about the year's statistics, you know, these aren't covered in real time. I think that with our, on average, 10 deaths, I mean, last year the numbers aren't official, but I think it's 10 or 11. We should be getting the official number soon. You know, I think that if the news covered every single one of those deaths in real time, all of a sudden people would really be standing up and taking notice. Because, I mean, give me something else that kills 10 otherwise healthy children in our community every single year. I don't think there is anything that people aren't aware of and already actively trying to counteract.
And so on the subject of culpability, liability, and this can be so, I mean, devastating to work through. Parents don't want to lose their kids. I want to read some remarks first, and then I want to talk about a specific news story. But tell me who Kirk Pirro is. He sent some remarks into the show.
He is a phenomenal investigator for RPD. That works investigating all crimes against children and homicides.
And so he's been there for a number of these
probably
cases.
Probably more so than any other officer in our community. There's a couple of officers that have probably experienced what he's experienced, but yeah.
So let me read some of Kirk's remarks about this. He writes to say, "Put the child in a crib alone with no pillows, no blankets or bumpers. Let them self-soothe. Leave the room if crying bothers you. No kid ever died from crying, but thousands die from what parents are suggesting with co-sleeping." And he knows in saying that, that is a blunt way of putting it to parents who are simply saying, "Hey, I love my kid. It's worked out fine." It sounds to me like Kirk is a guy who has experienced this enough that he's got a little bit shorter fuse with it. Is his blunt remarks there saying no child ever died from crying? Walk away if it bothers you to hear it. I mean, is that too blunt or what do you think?
Well, I think lots of parents worry about their child crying and they don't want their child to suffer in any way. I certainly understand his point because, again, it's so awful to go through these experiences with parents, understanding full on that we, of course, are not feeling what they're feeling, but just thinking about, even though I am not the parent in the situation, and knowing what I have felt and seen and how I remember every single one of those faces, I understand the raw emotion. 100%.
Yeah. Kirk says, "I'm just the guy that has to show up and deal with the newly destroyed by grief parents. Every time a kid dies from this, I also have two children. No amount of my sleep would have been worth that risk." We're hearing from a wide range of parents who say that they have followed the guidance and the recommendations from the experts and the evidence, and that they have not done it because of fear of risk, even when they have wanted to put the child in bed with them. And again, I mean, I've been there. I understand that. And just a final note from Chris, who again, by the way, like I mean, much love to you, Chris, as a mom and as a person. I mean, we're all doing our best. She says, "I will finish with this. The AAP recommends that infants sleep in the same room as their caregiver for 1 year, ideally, but at least 6 months, and stated to reduce SIDS by as much as 50%. So leave them and walk away isn't mindful of that guideline."
I guess I'm not exactly sure. So
again, she's saying AAP recommends infants sleep in the same room as their caregiver for at least a year, ideally. Kirk is saying, if crying bothers you, walk away, leave the room, because crying's never killed a child.
Well, that's true. I mean, so crying is not SIDS. But the reason I asked the authors of this paper specifically why 1 year, because that seemed awfully tough. And the reason they said that is that the numbers were not zero when it came to the second half of the first year of life with regards to SIDS deaths and unsafe sleep deaths. And so when it comes to SIDS specifically, there's some information out there that having another person around you, whether it's the parents breathing or the parents turning in bed or hearing different noises in the room, lightens certain amounts of sleep for everybody. And mm-hmm. so that if we don't really know the exact mechanism of SIDS, but there's some theories that it has to do with the baby's sleep cycle, and that if you can lessen the deep sleep cycles so the baby doesn't get in danger but still is able to sleep, that could be protective. And so the keeping the baby in the room for a year, if possible, has to do with some of the SIDS-specific data. And it's very much getting into the weeds, but scientists sometimes are like that because they knew that there was a very, very small, minuscule risk, but they didn't want to discount it because it was still a risk. You can walk out of a room for a few minutes when a baby is crying in a crib and do what you need to do to soothe and comfort yourself.
Decompress
because it
a little.
Is really jarring. Yeah. And your baby is going to be okay. They don't need to be left there forever, obviously. But taking a few minutes, letting your baby cry for 5 minutes, so you can take a moment and just regroup. When you've had a terrible day with your child, that is totally okay. And parents should always be given permission to do that, whether it's a toddler has lost their mind and you've had a terrible day with a toddler, or you can't figure out what's bothering the baby and you just need a few minutes, whatever that case is, we always as parents should be giving ourselves permission to put our child in a safe place and walk away for a few minutes so we can regroup, because it's so, so challenging to have a fussy child.
I'm someone who I've had to go to an overnight sleep study for some funky disorders I have. Because we all got something, Dr. Murray. And what I learned from Dr. Plotkin was, boy, there are some people in this world who know and understand and study and are experts in sleep much more than I am. I would be nervous, just speaking for myself, about concluding that, well, I'm a light sleeper. I would know. This would wake me up. I'm not an expert in sleep. I mean, we all sleep. But I'm not an expert enough to say, well, I'm a light enough sleeper that I would know. And the other thing that would probably strike me, again, I don't say this in a way that's sort of judgmental, just sort of kind of talking through this, is if you are sleep deprived, and we can all think of times where we've been sleep deprived, and when you finally get to sleep, what do we always say the next day? I slept hard. You know, like, it's like you slept, and if you're in that much of a sleep deprivation state, I would be worried that nothing could wake me. That would scare me.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I think the estimation of force is incorrect. You know, again, the what a baby needs to get themselves into danger is really, really so minor and so minuscule. Again, a simple sheet being put over a baby's face can cause them to rebreathe enough to that it could be devastating to them. Their arm gets stuck under a pillow. They're not going to be able to move. These are things that you would think we'd be able to overcome. But again, that first month or two of life, the babies just do not have the skills to clear their face, clear their airway.
Gary writes and says, as a police officer working overnights, I went to some of these death calls, and then maybe months later we'd return, be terrible situations. He talks about returning for domestic violence, even suicide. And he says, if you make a choice like this, you might never forgive yourself or your partner, and the baby isn't coming back. And I mean, that's tough. That's really heavy. But Gary's saying, I've been there as a police officer.
Yeah, and I think every officer who's covered any beat can tell you all these stories. And I think it made me think of something that, you know, this is such a multifactorial issue. This isn't necessarily people always wanting to bring the baby in bed with them because they're breastfeeding, they think it's best. There's a lot of people in our community who have very real safety concerns, very real unsafe housing concerns and what's going on in their environment. And mm-hmm. So they are sincerely trying to keep their child safe, and that they're not sure what's going on in their environment. Maybe it's a house that has a lot of rodents or bugs in it. And so keeping that baby with them is the very safest option there is. And so we're working, and the Baby Safe Sleep Coalition is working really hard to try to work with families on those factors, because it is not a one-size-fits-all.
Sure.
I agree with that concept completely, but there's a lot of different things that we can do. But right now we know that the education is provided for families. We can get any family who needs one a crib in our community, and there are plenty of resources out there, people willing to help.
Let me read from CBS News a story of twice in the same family. A woman in Central Florida was arrested following the second co-sleeping death of a newborn within 7 years apart. She was 25 years old. She had been 18 in the first time this happened. She was warned by numerous agencies about the dangers of sleeping in the same bed with an infant following the smothering death of her baby girl, 13-day-old baby girl. So she was 18 and she had a baby, and the baby died when the baby was 13 days old. The death, of course, we'll talk about this in a moment, was ruled accidental. 7 years later, she gave birth to another child, a boy, and she was warned again by a primary care physician about the dangers of sleeping with the infant during the infant's exam. And police said the mother had also completed a Healthy Start training program and was provided counseling and information how to properly put an infant to sleep on their back. But despite the warning, she co-slept, and her son died. And at that point, police decided to charge her with aggravated manslaughter of a child due to negligence in her son's death. Deputies determined that after the repeated warnings, the boy's death was through her own culpable negligence. But just a devastating
story. It's
really
hard to hear. It's so hard on so many levels because, you know, I think there's always more to a story. I'm not a police officer. I'm not from the district attorney's office. I have nothing to do with charges being brought. But to hear a family having to go through that twice,
it seems rare, though, right? I mean, to actually have charges brought.
Oh, very rare. I mean, well, certainly here. Other parts of the country might be doing something, but I'm not aware of any community that routinely would bring charges for a single case. The fact that it happened twice.
That has to be what prompted the charges.
I would assume so. I don't know for sure, but it sounds like they made the decision based on the fact that they had lots of evidence that she was provided with other information.
And let me read Iris's email. She says, co-sleeping is an emotional topic, and I'm shocked you have invited two pediatricians who agree it's dangerous and bad on your program today. Couldn't you have found an expert who offers an opposing opinion? She says there are several experts in the field who have offered the seven safe steps to co-sleeping. She cites a biological anthropologist who has written that book. She says, this is a safe way to share your bed with your baby. You may want to mention that. And it's a devastating mistake to conflate this with anti-vaxxers. Babies have slept with their parents since the dawn of time. We are actually the ones going against biology on this. I co-sleep and I do vaccinate my children. Go ahead, Dr. Murray.
So I'm not aware of any physicians or physician groups that support routine use of safe sleep. I'm aware of the anthropologist and those guidelines.
That's not a physician, to be clear.
Correct.
So I'll ask you directly. Do you have colleagues in your field who disagree with you on this that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
None.
There might be, but this is pretty clear. I mean, there's just so much evidence on this now. Once it was studied, there's just so much data.
Because she's frustrated, and I understand sometimes people are frustrated with who we book to be on this program. She's saying, look, you got two pediatricians who are against co-sleeping. Couldn't you have got pediatricians who are for co-sleeping? I don't know that I could have found any.
I agree with you. I don't know that you could have. And I think that, you know, do things happen differently in different countries? Yes, they definitely do. And the reality is we got to look at what's happening in our country, in our community. And some of this is very community-based. I think the reason for some of our unsafe sleep deaths here is very different in the city of Rochester than it would be in suburban communities in different places and in different parts of the country. You know, we have our own risk factors and we have to address them and very specifically. But again, the end of the day is these are always preventable.
So to the woman who wrote the email, I mean, again, I much love and respect to you as a parent because I know that you love your kids and there's no question about that. I am simply trying to find, as to the best of my journalistic ability, what the medical and scientific and research consensus is. And Dr. Murray's here not because she's just one opinion and I didn't want to book the other opinions. Her opinion is shaped by the evidence. And that's why we're having this conversation. It's not to judge or make parents. And I know we keep saying that, but it's important to me that people understand that. So Dr. Murray, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
And we all wish that we never had to have these kind of conversations.
Oh, I would be very happy to never look at a devastated parent's eyes again.
Yeah. Dr. Murray is an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital, always generous with her time. Our thanks as well to Dr. Stephen Schultz, who joined us earlier this hour, medical director and pediatrician at Rochester Regional Health's Finger Lakes Medical Associates in Geneva. Our thanks to Josephine, volunteering with us today. Thanks, Josephine. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.